Hello and welcome to Club Soderbergh, the chronological review of director Steven Soderbergh's feature films. As always, I am joined by my co-hosts Maggie Scott.
Hi.
And Jesse Scott.
Hello.
I'm beginning to think our linear telling of Soderbergh's films really misses the point of his career. I'm leaning towards editing this output into genre groupings or perhaps making it a choose-your-own-adventure a la the upcoming HBO Mosaic. In any event, we are at the midpoint and I'd like to hear some of your reflections as to your journey through one director's career chronologically or any other musings you may have specific to Soderbergh. What has this adventure made you think about in terms of making or a person's very public career, an oeuvre?
Well, I have really enjoyed going through someone's work. I haven't done this since I was probably a teenager, where I've got obsessed with filmmakers and just watched everything that person made. And I feel like I haven't done that for years and years. So it's been really enjoyable doing that with Steven Soderbergh. And in terms of patterns that I'm seeing, like I still think maybe at this point, this is where if we wanted to start like grouping his films into genre or theme or something like that, we could do it. But I feel like to this point we had to do chronological to really understand what his themes are and what, you know, what his style is like and all those kind of things. So now moving forward, I mean, I think I'd like to still go chronological.
Yeah, sure.
But theme-wise, you know, definitely I could say, you know, like I would want to watch Shay all in one go.
Yeah.
But we're going to be watching it in sort of staggered episodes.
But you can still watch it all in one go.
I can. Just, you know, no one's going to stop me from doing that.
Well, I'm actually thinking about it in terms of like when we come to the end as well, I'd love to do an episode where we each pick a film that we want to go back and revisit in the context now of having seen everything. I think that's going to be really interesting. But also like in a sort of categorical thing, like I think a lot of these films are quite like unofficial trilogies. Like there's a lot that have affinity with each other, or they're the same film made again and again and again, but with different technology, different zeitgeist pivot as the narrative, but still like the same story. So yeah, Jess, what do you think?
Well, I think this has been quite a new experience for me because unlike Maggie, I never have been an obsessive completist, so except for with Star Trek. But, but I've never been one to kind of fixate on a particular artist and then see everything that they've done. So that was a really valuable experience for me, and just sort of forcing yourself in this dispassionate way to kind of watch things that I wouldn't ordinarily watch.
Yeah.
But I had this revelation the other day reading about the stupid effing Ocean's films. And he was talking about one of the films he made subsequently. I think he was talking about Shay, and how when he starts out making a film, the first thing he does is kind of select a palette of shots that he's going to limit himself to within the filmmaking, and how in Ocean's it was all about zoom shots. And in Shay, it was all about avoiding close-ups because he wanted to show Shay as kind of a man of the people. And just that kind of his obsessive dedication to learning something new on every single film he makes, no matter what it is, no matter how big or small, his kind of discipline and drive to kind of use the filmmaking process, you know, in many different ways. Yeah, I find it really inspiring as an artist to kind of read about that and to understand his process more. And even, you know, even though he's done some god-awful films and some brilliant films, he just, whatever he's doing, he takes that approach of trying to push himself and find something new in it. And, yeah, it's kind of like a kick up the ass for me, I think.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, I think you've really touched on something that I've found also similarly very interesting in terms of, like, it's almost a paradox of almost unbridled ambition. And then he places the limitations around that.
Yeah.
So it's like to create, make us a utilitarian framework within the chaos of his ambition. And I think that's, you know, that's how he pulls off so much. You know, and you can see it in a macrocosm sense as well in terms of the work that he takes on and the way that he takes on the work.
Yeah.
As a program, I guess. Yeah, I'm like Maggie. I'm a full-on obsessive, I guess. That's the reason why I created this show. But I think it's particularly ambitious with such a large body of work. It's not something that I would have done unless I had the discipline of this show. So, yeah, I'm loving it.
Mm. It's a huge body. Yeah, really. I can't think of anyone else who's made this many various different films, you know, like tried everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess we'll have this discussion again when we get to the end. And so, well, briefly, let's move on to our next set of films, which I think will encapsulate this conversation quite well. Solaris is essentially a realised adaptation of the novel by Polish science fiction writer Stanisław Lem. Although Solaris has a fine pedigree, not only of what has preceded before it, but also stars George Clooney, Natasha McElhone, and is produced by James Cameron, you would think it sits in blockbuster territory, but it is firmly a high art existential space novella. I can't wait to discuss this film with you both. And our second film is the crowd-pleasing Ocean's 12 and is perhaps the hastily made sequel to 2001's Ocean's 11. Another certified blockbuster, it was the 10th highest grossing film for 2004, and you can tell this film was considered a license to print money. It's lush, extremely lush, and the filming seemed as complicated and decadent as an Ocean's Heist. Filmed in Atlantic City, New Jersey, Florida, Las Vegas at the Bellagio, Chicago, Amsterdam, Paris, Monte Carlo, Lake Como, Rome, Sicily, the Netherlands and Paris, and the cast is as large and rambling, with as many A-listers as you can poke a stick at, with quite a few additions to the first film's crew. It is essentially Ocean's 11 on steroids, with slightly better gender politics, but all things we will go into in a minute. First is first, Jesse, take it away with Solaris.
Chris. I'm so happy to see you. I love you so much. Don't you love me anymore?
I have to check out something with the crew.
So, this is a bit exciting today for me because as far as I know, this is Soderbergh's only real foray into sci-fi. And we have two bona fide sci-fi nerds on this podcast. And one who I'm sure that before the end of the decade I can bring around. Solaris from 2002 is a bit of a strange beast and, as you would by now expect, a bit of a genre bender. It's based not on the revered, if obscure, Tarkovsky film of the same name, but on the original source text of that film, the 1961 novel by Stanisław Lem. On one hand, Lem is a celebrated sci-fi author and Solaris is one of the classics of the genre, but without a doubt, the Tarkovsky film would be more well-known reference point to an American audience. Or perhaps Soderbergh thought both were kind of obscure enough to an audience that would go to see a George Clooney film anyway that it didn't really matter. Anyway, despite having just called myself a sci-fi nerd, I have to now admit that I've neither read the Lem novel and until this week had not actually seen the Tarkovsky film, which is sacrilege for a video artist to admit. So on the whole, I kind of had to take the Soderbergh film on its own merits and I guess its relationship to other works in the sci-fi universe, let us say. Although I do have some notes, which we can talk about later, about how it differs from the Tarkovsky film or is similar to it. So far from being a cool, airy, conceptual sci-fi opera a la 2001 A Space Odyssey, this film reminded me most of the recent Denis Villeneuve, Amy Adams vehicle Arrival. It's incredibly beautiful in a similar kind of melancholy, quiet way, each scene feeling hermetically sealed from the next, especially in the opening sequence. It also managed to balance this very human emotional story of grief with classic philosophical and existential sci-fi questions, as well as pull off some creepy alien action at the same time. Probably the input from James Cameron, I'd imagine. George Clooney was lovely in this film, subtle and with, you know, little of that Danny Ocean smarm, which we'd just seen in the Ocean's films. And yet, there have been so many great kind of indie or low-key sci-fi films in the last couple of years, And I wonder if films like this work better when the lead is less of a rolled gold star. So my question this week is, would this have worked better carrying less baggage in the talent department, or is that just a dumb question? What do you guys think?
Oh, well, there are no dumb questions.
No, there are. No, go on.
I don't think it's a dumb question because, unlike you guys, I'm not much of a George Clooney fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know, I didn't not like him. He was fine. He carried it. But he also, Soderbergh had Daniel Day-Lewis in mind for this. And
oh, my
Daniel
God,
Day-Lewis
that would have
wasn't
been amazing.
Working. Yeah, I reckon too. I think that would have been amazing. Someone a bit more kind of
well, like, for lack of a better word, gravity. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, is it a bit more hard-faced and kind of, I don't know, melancholy or something? Like, George is just too kind of...
He's so dark and brooding, though. Like, I think him as a psychologist is great. But I'm just going to put this out there and I hope you guys don't hate... Like, I actually think he's a really bad actor. Like, he has a presence, right, that is undeniable. Mm. And he's really unusual looking. Like, he's so racially ambiguous. I find that really magnetic in terms of his looks. But... his facial expressions are just, they're just so hammy. Like, and he just looked like he was trying, like his horror face or whatever. It's like, you know, I just think of him in a Coen Brothers movie. Like, it just looks like screwball horror. So apart from his expressions, I actually thought he was quite good in this. I liked him in this. But I think if it really wanted to go down the full, like, Russian existential pain of being alive route, a different actor would have been more appropriate and it would have given it that real, you know. But it may have been, like, so fucking hard to watch, though. Do you know what I mean?
I reckon, you know, it didn't need to go down that existential path like that, but it was more of a love story, this version of Solaris. Like, it was more about the couple. It's still... addressed philosophical questions, but I felt like it was more about men and women and how they relate to each other.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's what I took from it because I think they completely misunderstood each other.
I should probably explain something of the plot to this point, that George Clooney plays a psychologist who's kind of called to action to come to this space station on this planet sometime in the future called Solaris that people are studying because... strange things are happening. They're trying to figure out how the planet works. And when he gets there, he goes to sleep and wakes up and his dead wife is in his bedroom. And that's basically kind of the start of the action. And the film is about how he deals with that scenario of, you know, this is she alive? Is she dead? Is she really his wife? Is she an alien being? She starts to have kind of
doesn't matter.
But also, there's baggage there because she committed suicide.
She committed suicide
and again.
Feels guilty.
And again. And again. Yeah. And again.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What did you think of Carla? What did you think of the plot and the character of the wife?
Even though I think space was actually a perfect backdrop for this kind of extremely deep film. I have to say this, like, up front, to say that this film was a profound revelation to me, and it has fast become, like, top 10 of my favourite films of all time. I cannot even believe how amazing this film is. And apart from, like, the production design, which was just so stunning, like, like IKEA, 80s IKEA, the future of the past.
And it's also like a future without collars.
Yeah.
And space beds.
Yeah.
You know.
Very thin mattresses.
Yeah, but it's the production design was amazing and I'm gutted that I saw this movie after Moon because Moon was like that real cornerstone in sci-fi for me. And if I had seen this film when it had come out, I would have thought Moon was, you know, copying it. Mm. So someone like what's his name, Sam?
I know who you're talking about. I can't remember his
name. The guy from Moon. Anyway, he's a great he's a good actor to think about in a part like that. But ultimately, I thought space was a perfect metaphorical, you know, container. I don't want to say space again to tell this story. But I find that interesting that you think it's about men and women, whereas, you know, psychology student here, it's that that we as people, we do not exist without being reflected in others. Like we construct our identities by a process of absence rather than being. Do you know what I mean? And that these people were nothing, that we're prisoners to how we are reflected in other people, but we're also a prisoner to our memories of other people and other people's memories of us. And I thought that that was such a profound way of telling that story, and that we all in some way live a fantasy or a deconstructed, constructed version of our reality. And yeah, I'm sort of getting off track.
Yeah, but all of those things, Carla, I think you're right. But it was told, those questions are brought about through this love story. And I guess because I watched Tarkovsky's Solaris, it's perhaps a bit more about colonialism.
And interesting.
The idea of, you know, like, you know, what do you fight? Do you radiate the surface of Solaris and fight back and destroy it, or just retreat and get the fuck away from there? Or do you fall in love with the alien and just get involved? And
I found it's really interesting, like, listening to both of those interpretations, because I haven't read the book, but I sense that it's quite influential. Like you saying, you know, about Moon, I'd say that Moon is very influenced by the Lem novel as well. So that I think that these concepts pervade sci-fi in many different contexts. But the thing that I kept coming back to was, is this just a very long episode of Star Trek? Because it feels like this is a type of storyline that Star Trek really kind of often has, because Star Trek's all about, you know, like how through the attempt to communicate with the other we can learn more about ourselves, or how we can, you know, that process can be, you know, positive. It's a utopian vision. But both the Tarkovsky and Solaris film are really melancholy and kind of dystopian, or not dystopian, but, you know, kind of a more hopeless vision of how, I guess,
we destroy everything we touch.
Well, we can't really incorporate both. We can't really have the conscious and the subconscious integrated, that we have to choose one or the other. Because at the end of, you know, the Soderbergh film, he decides, I would rather the fantasy and the projection than going back to reality without her. At the end of the Tarkovsky film, he chooses to be immersed in this false subconscious memory world rather than go back to reality. They're slightly different, you know, takes on the same theme. But, so I kept thinking about, you know, how this one text has influenced sci-fi in so many different ways, that it's been reinterpreted in so many different ways.
But I think, like, in a meta, I mean, even a more meta version of that psychologically, that when we're starting to explore space or think about space, we really put the edges of humanity to its test.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, apart from the literal distance, the figurative distance, the psychological distance, but also the opportunity for everything to be new. So what would we choose if we could start all over again? And I think that has been the basis of all sci-fi, and that's why it is the most progressive medium, because, you know, we can have these philosophical discussions about, you know, future humanity. But I also think, this was a theological discussion as well. Like, I feel like spiritual. The camera was Solaris. Like, I watched this 3 times before this show, because I was just so blown away. And by the 3rd viewing, I was like, this is an omnipresent eye, the camera, you know. And just so much production elements in, like, the framing, the close-ups, the wide shots, the perfect Cliff Martinez soundtrack. Like, this was a perfect storm of everything that he does well into something so amazing. But the clone or alien, Natasha McElhone, says, you know, it created me, but I can't communicate with it. And the other quote is, there are no answers, only choices.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I guess Solaris, the planet, is almost like a purgatory or a, like a heavenly body, maybe, like the way that it, you know, brings it, if you read it as a spiritual kind of text, then the way that it brings back when you die, you just go into your memories. It's what you, how you have lived is what you get back when you die. And ultimately George Clooney's character, Calvin, kind of kills himself.
Yeah.
Basically, like it's a...
And goes back to this, yeah, this place where he feels guilt and remorse, yeah, and, yeah, you know, to relive, you know,
and
to
that's try how and, he's lived, you know. Yeah, yeah.
I feel like there's also a really interesting thing in both the film versions about, you know, human beings and others. And there's lots of different ways you can kind of read that, you know, as a metaphor, but there's this real kind of distinction being made all the time that, you know, the other characters are saying, but it's not human. Stop thinking of it as human, therefore we can kill it.
Mm.
And he's saying, but it's irrelevant whether it's human, it's another being that I'm communicating with. Mm. We can't kill it. And I think that's kind of a really, I don't know, I was really struck by that. I found that really interesting, especially, again, in relation to Star Trek, which I'm just blatantly going to keep bringing up because obviously that's such a huge, you know, kind of like guiding principle in Star Trek is that, you know, we have to respect other beings and just because they're different to us, you know, we have to respect that difference. And, yeah, I don't know if you've been keeping up with Discovery, Carla.
Of course I have.
Yeah, of course you have. In the last episode, how she, you know, has that argument with her colleague about, you know, just because we feel threatened by this being, it doesn't mean that it's actually threatening us.
And, yeah.
Yeah, working through those kind of issues. So I thought that was kind of like maybe underplayed a bit, but I still thought it was a really powerful part of the film.
Mm. And so the character played by Viola Davis in Solaris is that voice of rationality and
reason,
science, and, you know, we have to just laser this thing and get out of here, back away. We don't understand this. This isn't, you know, we need to, you know, which is a very human attitude to science and to space exploration, very cautious.
But also entirely pragmatic. I mean, the entire crew had killed themselves.
Yeah.
Or, you know, bar one person, you know, that is survival because this presence, whatever it is, was not peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and whether that's because, you know, man is inherently dangerous and that is the reflection that happens, it was, you know, what she needed to survive was to leave.
Yeah.
But I find this colonialism thing fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
Especially because Natasha McElhone's character, you know, she's just basically like, well, she kills herself because she's like, I'm not meant to be here. And even if I was meant to be here, I am entirely constructed by somebody else's reality of me and I don't want to participate in that.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a really powerful character. It made me think
amazing of, actress too. Like, amazing. I found her very haunting. Her face was so I just felt really creeped out every time. You know, because she was kind of beautiful, but at the same time, really creepy. And you never knew what was going to happen.
Yeah,
next.
That was the kind of you know, alien kind of part where it was like, is she going to like go, you know, crazy and
like, you know, tentacles going to come out of it.
I also thought like it made me think about you know, Soderbergh through a feminist lens,
because
I've been thinking about this a lot. I really don't think he's a feminist. I would
interesting.
I don't think that he is. Like, I don't think he's a self-avowed feminist. I don't think he's a self-conscious feminist. But I feel like in many of his films, his female characters have this quality of, like, having agency and having fully fleshed reality that feels revelatory because he's so absent from so many other films.
Yeah.
And I felt that really strongly in this film that the idea that she was a projection of his is so clear in that scene where they're having dinner. It's a flashback to them having dinner. She's remembering it. And, you know, she's talking about her religious beliefs, her spiritual beliefs, and these two men just start fucking mansplaining her beliefs to her.
Yeah.
And they just at some point go mute and she's just staring at them like, you know, like overbearingly kind of explaining herself to her, and then she just walks out.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's an amazing insight for a male director to include that, you know, to be able to, I don't know, it shouldn't be. Like, I'm aware that as I'm saying this, that shouldn't be an amazing insight for a male to have, but, like, it is.
But that's why I thought this film was about, you know, how men and women relate to each other, but also the other is also men, you know, woman to man, as well as in colonial context.
Yeah.
Like, I think that, you know, all those themes kind of
circulate.
But I find the feminist argument of her, like, really fascinating as well, and also quite lucid, because in the first life, in the real life, in the human life that she had, she chose to kill herself.
Mm.
And he did not accept that.
Mm.
So once she comes back, he didn't accept it again and again and again, mm-hmm. even though it was this alien being's agency to do this.
Mm.
So just this total, you know, ploughing of a person's agency just because she chose to do something that he didn't want. Well, double, because she killed herself because she had an abortion that he disagreed with,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, yeah, and that fits well with the colonialism narrative as well, the the paternalism of the all-knowing male doctor, you know.
Yeah.
So I also thought, I mean, yeah, that's what I was saying about his guilt. It's not only a projection of his idea of her, but it's also a projection of his guilt and realization of all that, that he keeps reliving. I think I really loved this film too. I did find the end of it a little bit on the nose. Maybe it was a bit schmaltzy and romantic. I don't know. What was your take on that, Carla? Did you see that differently to me, or?
Yeah, I saw it as him controlling it again to the end.
Yeah.
So he chose to kill himself so that he could remain in the fantasy that he was constantly having rejected by Solaris.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He chose to die and live what he wanted to live rather than go back to reality.
Mm. The way I saw that is that he went back to Earth and he was a copy like Snow.
Oh, interesting.
And so you know, the alien from Solaris has actually penetrated Earth.
Colonized.
That's the way I read. I mean, okay. I might have missed.
No, I had that opinion the first time.
Yeah.
And then the second time.
It's very clear that he has killed himself or he's gone into a kind of Solaris.
But who's to say that he just didn't die on Solaris and the copy came back?
Yeah, that's what that's what I thought.
In the Tarkovsky film, spoiler alert, the final scene you see that he goes back to this, like, so it returns to this opening scene of the film in a similar way, and he's going to his father's house, but things are not quite right, and then it kind of zooms out. And you see that it's an island on Solaris, mm-hmm. and he's like living in this weird simulacrum of, you know, this memory he has of his father's home.
Mm.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think I read it the same way you did, Carla, but I like that you had a different reading.
I think it could be both.
I
think, you know, I think they are simultaneously correct. Did you like the film, Maggie?
I loved it.
Oh, yeah.
I loved it. I loved Tarkovsky's version better.
I haven't seen it yet. I'll have to get on to
it. I loved both of them. And I read an interview or a review on Guardian that said, you know, this was okay. Solaris by Soderbergh was okay. It was a bit of a Cliff's Note or a, you know, like Solaris for Dummies for American audiences. But I don't think that's fair. I think it's actually
it's a different film.
A great version of the novel or the Tarkovsky, you know, like it's, I think it's wonderful. I loved it.
Yeah, this has been a revelation for me.
Made me think.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Tarkovsky film?
No. I'm saying Soderbergh's Solaris, yeah.
It's really, it's beautiful, but it's a totally different approach. It's an experiential film, so it's really long and a lot of the sequence. But it's designed for the cinema, so it's like, you know, you have to imagine that you're sitting in a cinema being immersed in these incredible shots.
Yeah.
And it's impressionistic. He's using the whole architecture of the cinema to tell a story, not just the plot, not just sort of the action.
Mm.
So it's a different approach and it's more poetic. There's actually a lot more exposition in it.
I think you were
saying, Maggie, there's heaps more exposition, so it's a little bit more wordy, even though it's longer and slower.
Mm.
Whereas the Soderbergh version, I think, is like
so tight.
It's amazing.
It's good.
Yeah. And I have to say, this is the moment that I had hoped I would have doing the show.
Yeah.
That I would just unearth something that was completely life-changing. And
That's how I felt about this film
too. Oh, it's beautiful.
Like, yeah, I loved it too.
Definitely.
Solaris has bewitched us.
Appropriately.
So, we done? Issue closed?
Is it actually good?
It's good. Trust me.
I don't trust you, Ruben, and I don't trust Ocean. If it's good, we're done.
These grudges, they're awful. Nobody wins. Danny's had enough of this, Michigas. And the competition, it's worse than our business. Always some new young punk trying to prove himself.
Guys like Ocean, they keep coming back. They don't like to lose. Too much ego, too much pride.
It may be for some guys, but not Danny. You could trust me on that. Actually, Danny don't feel like he lost in all this. It's hard to believe, but that's how he feels.
Well, if he tries anything, if anybody tries anything, I'll be waiting.
Now it's time for Ocean's 12, a convoluted plot taking place over several countries and several stretches of just go with it plausibility. I'm just going to launch in and say I found this film even more dire than the first and struggled to stay awake. The gist of the plot, as I struggle to recall it, is the gang are held accountable by Terry Benedict to give back his money plus interest. They all hit Europe to avoid suspicion to start pulling off heists to get the money together. Terrible switcheroos, holograms, Julia Roberts playing Tess, playing a pregnant Julia Roberts, and the 12th Ocean, which I genuinely couldn't figure out who it was meant to be. Perhaps I can't count. I'm hoping the gang can help me understand the plot to this film. Perhaps there isn't even really one. Ladies, what did you think? Is this Ocean's 11 meets Full Frontal shot with an embiggenator?
I'm just going to say up front, this is going to be really tough for me, this segment, because I have virtually nothing to say about this dumb, dumb film.
Oh, my God.
I found this completely unmemorable. And, I enjoyed watching it because there were some funny moments, such as Terry Benedict's neckerchiefs and cane and rose-tinted glasses. There's some hilarious little moments, but overall I think the only insight I had was that in terms of the heist film as, you know, a ragtag bunch of outsiders, you know, getting it together to kind of do something radical, I think I liked that, the Ocean's crew are all kind of doing normal things in their life, but not really very well. Mm. And I like that kind of opening scene where he visits each of them to tell them he wants his money back.
Yeah.
And they're all just like doing kind of boring things. And, you know, but that was, even that wasn't great. It's just, you know, that's all I have to say about it.
Everyone was phoning it in on this.
Oh, totally. And I mean, not to mention the writers, like, yeah, like who was the 12th one? I don't know. There's so many characters.
Wasn't it the guy who did the holograms?
No, I think it was meant to be Julie, because I'm like, okay, so Mr. Barbara Streisand, what's his name?
Oh, Elliot Gould.
Yeah, so I thought Elliot Gould was, like, in the original 12. He was Mr. Barbara Streisand, by the way.
Right.
But then he was, like, not in it. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe Julie Roberts is the 12th one because she ends up playing a part. But then Elliot Gould actually ends up coming over and, like, you know, surprise. So whatever, who gives a shit, right? Like,
there's too many characters.
It was ludicrous.
The whole problem with these movies is that having, like, upping the ante every time, it's like, you can't even keep track of 11 of them, let alone 12 or 13.
Or even care, like,
no,
you know what I mean?
But, I mean, the ones who get left out, like, I find it really, you know, like, really telling that the ones who get left out are the woman, the person of colour, the Chinese person. Yeah. Like, it's very... Yeah.
Just focuses on the boring main guys.
White guys. Like,
but, you know, it's just ludicrous, this film. Like, the plot, like you say... Just, you know, the whole thing is just it's playing it straight until the very end when you're like, oh, they were all in on it all along. And how clever
like
is that?
Like the first
and
one.
Why the fuck would you go to that, you know, length to, it's just, ugh.
And so then I also, like, I find it absolutely phenomenal that we can discuss Solaris and this film in the same episode, by the way. But then I also love the love/hate the, you know, gesture towards no women being participating in the first one, to then we get, like, daddy issues Catherine Zeta-Jones in this. Gross. Like, what even was that?
It was so dumb and tacked on and whatever.
And the music and that offensive. Played behind them when her and Rusty
saw, oh my
that kind of spritzy piano music.
This was like watching a businessman's junket, essentially. Like, you know, it's like watching 12 businessmen go across Europe trying to sell things, and you're like the ever suffering fucking coordinator that has to go around, you know, picking up after them. It was appalling.
It's crap.
I can't believe we have another one of these two.
I'm happy to end it on that note. I think that's the perfect. We don't need to go beyond that.
All right. Okay, press pause.
Press pause, press pause. First, Solaris. This is just a thought more than a fun fact. another way to look at it, this film, is that it's like Kevin and Winnie from Wonder Years.
That's exactly what I thought.
Did you?
No. Thank you.
They both kind of look like those guys 40 years later.
That's interesting.
And it's like they're trying to rekindle their lost love or something 40 years later. Just.
But yeah. I think you're spot on about the man-woman thing because, you know, the poster for the film is just those two kissing.
Yeah.
That's it. Like the sex full front, as well. Full we front of their that. Face. The well, I w- yeah, we didn't talk about shirtless George Clooney like the whole time. I thought Jesse would bring it up. It'd be the only thing we talk about.
Well, I was a bit distracted by the vision of the guy who played the same character in Tarkovsky's film, who had like a bright yellow mesh singlet on the whole time and like leather pants with like lace up sides. It was like very hard to get that image out of my head.
Bone buster. I actually completely forgot to prepare anything for this, so well, it's up to you two.
I've got one, which came from came straight from the Wikipedia page. It was basically about Lem Stanislaw saying that he kind of really hated American sci-fi, and he only was really into Philip K. Dick, and he was kind of the only one he gave props to. But Philip K. Dick, on the other hand, suffering from apparently mental health issues, maintained that Stanislaw Lem was probably a false name used by a composite committee operating on orders of the Communist Party to gain control over public opinion, and wrote a letter to the FBI to that effect.
Oh my God.
So I just thought that was like a hilarious kind of, such, bit of sci-fi bitchery.
That is such an intense view into Philip K. Dick's mind. Like,
that's a view
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. You know? Do we have any other bits of gossip?
Well, I kind of thought that it might be interesting to talk about Harvey Weinstein in this section because it's been such a big feature of news in the last couple of weeks and, you know, really obviously horrible revelations that have come out. But, I'm just wondering why hasn't Soderbergh commented on it yet?
He doesn't feel like a dude to really comment on anything beyond himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he doesn't make. But also it was a couple. I mean, I guess it's big because his breakthrough movie.
It was his breakthrough movie. I don't think he's had that much
Sex
to do with
Sex Lies
Weinstein.
Was the first big hit for Miramax. That's true. Yeah.
But Weinstein executive produced Full Frontal. And that is interesting because Gus Delario is such a disgusting producer and that whole happy ending scene with the masseuse, you know.
In the hotel room.
Sort of smacks of Weinstein.
Oh, look, honestly, it could be anyone in Hollywood. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
True. Yeah, I don't think it was.
But interestingly enough, George Clooney has spoken out about it at length.
Yeah.
And, you know, sorry, I should say Mr. Amal Clooney. And he clearly, you know, is on board with having a human rights lawyer for a wife. And I thought his statement was really nice. Like, not nice, that's not an appropriate thing to say. Like, it was, you know, it was an appropriate statement. He said, you know, that he'd heard the rumors over the years, but he'd always thought that that was a campaign to, you know,
discredit
women and their talents, and that he never really paid any mind to that, but that he fully believes women and he believes everybody who's come forward and, you know, that he wants to support them, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's such an interesting point because that's something that's quite horrifying is that so many of the rumors have been brushed aside as, you know, like you know, even when they're like rumors about him, about Weinstein, it still blows back negatively on the women that somehow they've got ahead by sleeping with him instead of, you know, oh no, he's a sleazebag who takes advantage.
He had a lot of power.
Anyway, what a creep.
Massive. And, you know, it feels like we'll just have one a year of these.
I think so.
Hopefully forever. Yeah. But I found it really interesting. Also, Tippi Hendren. Mm.
From The Birds.
From The Birds, Melanie Griffith's mother. Mm. She chimed in as well, and she was like, I'm so glad people are talking about this. This was basically what it was all like when I was an actress in, you know, the 50s. And, you know, basically we need to... you know, the only antiseptic is daylight to this kind of stuff. But the whole Rose McGowan thing has been really fucking horrifying. Like, I thought that she was just talking out about him, but she alleges that he raped her.
Yeah.
Like, this is how sort of big that this is going. So more power to these women talking out, and absolutely, hopefully this just, you know, continues to happen.
And I agree. I think hopefully that it also draws light on people like Hitchcock, on people like... who's the guy who has been Roman Polanski, you know, like more has come out about him in recent weeks as well, that, you know, it was so easy to brush these things aside. I think some people find it so easy to brush these things aside, you know.
Well, because they're so common, I think, like people are like, oh, well, and most people like have been sexually assaulted, including men, like as children. Do you know what I mean? Well, that's my opinion of it all, so I don't know. But I think we would be hypocritical if we didn't actually mention an incident with Soderbergh.
Yeah.
And the he was out in Sydney directing a play for the Sydney Theatre Company called Top Mom. I don't know, maybe like early 2010s, I think. Anyway, he and his wife were quote-unquote on a break during that time, and he had an affair with a young woman in Sydney, and she got pregnant and she had the child, and they had a pretty ugly paternity suit. He's never gone on the record with saying anything about it, so we only really have her side of things, but it looked like he's never met the child, and it was a pretty ugly paternity suit. But, you know, that's only one side of the story, we don't know. But that is something that he does have in his past as well.
But it certainly leaves, you know, a negative cloud around that situation. Even though we don't know what happened, it still, I don't know, makes me wince a little bit.
Yeah, it's not, I don't know. You don't know, though.
Yeah.
But the woman has certainly said that, you know, getting him to claim paternity on the child was very difficult, and that doesn't paint a positive light.
Yep.
Well, that's a bummer, but
sorry.
Did you have anything else, Carla?
I did not prepare for this. No. So yeah. I would have loved to have seen the Tarkovsky film, but I will soon. And thus ends episode 7 of Club Soderbergh. Next month we'll be talking about Eye Bubble and The Good German, both films I haven't seen and know nothing about, so I'm very much looking forward to watching those. If you haven't caught up on our earlier episodes, there's still time to get up to scratch on the chronological filmography of Steven Soderbergh. You can subscribe to us on BeyondPod, TuneIn, iTunes, and wherever great podcasts are found. Thanks always to Zeph, our sound engineer extraordinaire and gracious host. We'd love to hear from you, hear about your impressions of Soderbergh films or your favourite bits of trivia. You can contact the team at club@clubsoderbergh.com, the Facebook page at Club Soderbergh, same for Twitter, and we'd really love to be engaged with you, so please don't be shy. See you in a month for more Club Soderbergh on the rocks.